This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Tim Henney. Today we speak with a fifth-generation beekeeper about the fascinating world of bees, of a young girl's coming of age, about loss, and about how family is much like the world of bees with its very complex ecosystem. Meredith May is a Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist who wrote for the San Francisco Chronicle for 16 years. She lives in San Francisco, where she keeps bees in a community garden. She joins us today to talk about her new book called The Honey Bus, a memoir of loss, courage, and a girl saved by bees. Meredith May, welcome to The Mountain Life. Great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I just have to start with this. From 2011 to 2014, I believe it was, you kept bees on the roof of the San Francisco Chronicle. Wow.
I did.
How'd that go over?
Yeah, one of the busiest intersections in the whole city at 5th and Mission. There were four parking garages, restaurants, bars, and Bloomingdale's right there. And we had the main Chronicle building, but then we had a side building down in a little alley that housed the food writers, and we had a test kitchen in there, and this beautiful old freight elevator that went to the roof, and there was a rooftop garden up there because the writers would grow different things and then do test recipes with them, and so it was the perfect location. It was elevated and away from people and in full sun, and there were fruit trees and all kinds of vegetables, and we put a lot of pollinator flowers up there to help the bees. And then I used it as an excuse to write a beekeeping column. And, you know, I would take breaks from my desk and put on my bee suit and just commune with the bees for an hour. It was great, like midday therapy.
Oh, yes. So there are trends, especially in urban settings, things like keeping chickens in your backyard and urban beekeeping. Where were you in amongst that trend? Were you the trendsetter? Were you joining in on a movement?
Oh, I was definitely joining. San Francisco, and especially Oakland right now, is super into homesteading in an urban environment. And there were all kinds of amazing little fun stories I was doing. I remember there was one that I got involved with. Sunset Magazine was having some kind of contest where they picked different communities and or different people living in different communities, and it was a contest to have this beautiful dinner with many courses, and everything had to be hyper-local, like within 100 meters of your house, something like that. Mm-hmm. And there was a couple in Oakland that was involved in the contest, and I remember they got a monkey-faced eel from the bay, like somebody
Whoa.
Does pole fishing and, like, taught them. So they had to find all these people in the community who harvest their own food, forage their own food, and they had a neighbor who had goats or something and provided goat meat. And it's just, it's really, really big in the Bay Area. I think people in urban settings are clamoring for nature.
Meredith, does that have the potential to really change the character and culture of the urban landscape, or is it just sort of a nice thing that's kind of happening here and there, but doesn't really have the potential to become an organizing principle? Because it seems like such a great idea if it could gain traction with enough people that it could actually become the way that we organize our urban environments.
I agree with your hopefulness about this. I can only speak to the Bay Area, but it is definitely a movement. Michael Pollan lives here, and he's sort of our guru of this. And, you know, of course, Alice Waters started this, you know, in the 70s, the Chez Panisse. So we're sort of an epicenter of living really close to the earth. I mean, most of my friends grow their own vegetables in their backyard, no matter how cemented their backyard is. And there's just a really ritualistic gathering at the farmers markets on Saturday and Sunday, and a lot of people also locally source their meats as well. They groups of friends go in together and buy a whole pig or a whole cow and split the meat and keep it in freezers. And they're very careful about buying pasture-raised animals. And there's a lot of disposable income, too, in the Bay Area. So people have the luxury to do this because it's very expensive. You know, what really needs to happen is this kind of lifestyle needs to become affordable for regular working folk like myself.
And when you had those bees up on the top of the San Francisco Chronicle and you were communing with them, which, you know, provided benefit to you, were there any times where there was, where you were sort of like, whoops, that was an unintended event or happening? I mean, I know in your book you talk about bee swarms and some of the perils and you getting stung as a child and all that kind of stuff. So were there any encounters with your bees on the roof that you sort of look back on and go, huh, that could have gone a little differently?
Oh, God, which one to pick? because we were sort of bumbling beekeepers. Like, it was me and my editor, Deb Wandell, and she was brand new, and I had just a child's knowledge of beekeeping. I didn't understand this whole pest management aspect to it and swarming and how to ensure or try to ensure that they don't swarm. But they do. That's their nature. That's the way they propagate out in the wild. And you really don't want to have that happen right next to bloomies. So we did not realize how quickly bee colonies of 5,000 turned into bee colonies of 50,000. And so we were not stacking more boxes on the top to give them more room as they expanded. We weren't doing that quickly enough. And then one day I came to work and there were mad messages on all my devices that the bees had swarmed into the company parking lot and into this poor guy's parking space, and he couldn't park. He was too scared to pull in. And so we had to scoop them up and find a new home for them. But we learned the hard way. They actually swarmed twice, and once was on a weekend, and they landed on a chain link fence right outside a little dive bar there in the alley. And apparently it was like big excitement. The whole bar came out.
I would imagine. And I would think it would be hard to do guerrilla beekeeping, sort of trying to keep everything off the radar by having one little box when your population requires that you go sky high with your boxes. That sort of, is in conflict with the idea of keeping everything on the lowdown.
Well, yeah, and plus I was totally, showing off. I was, like, taking lots of photos and posting them and writing these columns. And I was kind of like, I was beekeeping in a skirt and, people were coming to visit all the time. Everyone wanted to see the hives. And I was getting stung a lot myself and kind of harassing the bees too much. Now that I know what I know, I would never open them that often as I did. But I was excited, and I wanted to share the bees, and the readers were excited, and they were a little bit of a party trick there for a while. And so I feel a little sheepish that I wasn't a better steward, but I am now.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Meredith May. She has written a book called The Honey Bus, a memoir of loss, courage, and a girl saved by bees. Meredith spent 16 years at the San Francisco Chronicle. Her narrative reporting won the Penn USA Literary Award for journalism. She was shortlisted for the Pulitzer Prize. And now she's telling the story, this memoir, of, growing up. And really, it's such a great metaphor between how bees, how they swarm, how they work together, how they survive, how they persevere. And you find at a young age that bees are teaching you how to survive and surmount a difficult time where your family is broken and your mother is sort of plunging into the depths of depression. Can you talk about the first time you realized that bees were going to help you sort of survive this thing that you found yourself in?
Sure. A lot of my understanding of this, though, came as an adult when I started keeping bees again. All these memories came flooding back about my relationship with them as a girl. And then I started understanding what the bees had been for me. But all I knew as a little kid is that I felt very soothed when I was near bees. For me, the safest place to be was like in the middle of a swarm. Yeah. And I know that sounds really backwards, but bees do not want to, honeybees, I should say, do not want to sting you. They know that if they sting you, they're going to die because their stinger comes out. So they fly around you. They try to avoid you. And they're really, the only times I'm stung is when I accidentally put my hand on one or sit on one, or I don't see it and I get in their way. But I used, my mother was a depressive. She, after the divorce, took me and my little brother away from my dad in Rhode Island and moved back into her childhood bedroom in Northern California with the two of us. And we shared a room together for the next decade. And most of that time, she was in bed. And so I was kind of a lonely kid, but I found friendship in the bees. I would go with my grandfather to his bee yards in Big Sur and watch them, and I would see like how the I would see the mother-daughter bond between the queen and the worker bee daughters, because she, the queen, is the only one who can lay eggs, but she can't feed herself or keep warm at night and needs her daughters to take care of her. So I think that was kind of showing me that the maternal instinct is universal. It's everywhere. It normally should be trusted, and it's even in insects, and that made me feel better.
Mm. So you now are a fifth-generation beekeeper. The story is as much about your grandfather as it is about anyone else. What a wonderful man, and you can just, the way you describe him, well, there are some photos in the book that helps give an image, but really you give an image with your words. And you start the book off with this beautiful prologue on, you know, you're sitting around eating breakfast and your grandpa gets the call, you know, it's like the emergency call, and we got to leave our breakfast and jump in the truck and go up Carmel Valley Road and help out a business with this swarm of bees. And then what happens is just the most amazing story.
Do you want me to say what happened?
Yes.
Okay. I think that was my cue. Yes, we go barreling down the road in his truck, and there is a swarm hanging from a tree at a tennis ranch. And the reason we have to go so fast is that a swarm is really a bee colony that's divided, and they're in between homes. They've scouted out a new location, and they might not be on the tree when we get there. They may already move to their spot. And as a beekeeper, you want those bees. You want to put them in your hive in your backyard, because more bees is more honey, more love, more energy just in your world. So we're breaking the speed limit, and we get there. Grandpa is sawing the branch down where the cluster is hanging, and I'm just watching a few feet away. And then somebody starts up a weed whacker, and it startles the bees, and they all go flying, and they're upset. What they're doing, that cluster, is they're protecting the queen. She's in the center of it, so they're worried about her, and they're defending her. And about, I don't know how many, but at least five got tangled in my hair, and they were started to attack me and sting me, and I didn't make a sound. I just fell to my knees and was trying to shake them out. And Grandpa saw and came running and rescued me. But it was a big test. You know, he put me in the truck and he said, you know, honk the horn if you start to pass out. And
that's the part that got
me. Was, yeah. And I didn't pass out. And I just had a lumpy head. And he was so proud of me for that. And he says, you know, I'm really proud of you. You didn't scream or nothing. And he said, you're going to be a beekeeper. And I just felt like, oh, I'm going to be a superhero like Grandpa. And I never forgot that.
Meredith, I have a big question about why beekeeping is so appealing to so many people. But I'd like to sort of try to deconstruct it in a different way and ask you about your relationship with bees and beekeeping. And do you think that that relationship is available to a great number of people, or did that happen because of the context and the environment that you were dealing with and sort of the special aspects of your family system and what that created and allowed for in this relationship with bees and how calming they were to you? So I guess the question is, what happened for you? Is that available to other people on sort of a mass scale? And there's some evidence that it would be because a lot of people keep bees.
Yeah. And like my grandfather, I have gotten a lot of my friends started keeping bees. And, you know, I start out mentoring them pretty seriously, and then I slowly back away, and then pretty soon they're doing it themselves. And, yes, I think beekeeping is available to anyone who's willing to put in the time and the commitment, and then the magic of bees will win them over within, you know, months of doing it, because they are such incredible creatures. It's extremely popular right now, at least in the urban centers, because people are aware that bees are in trouble. And, you know, the New York Times has been writing a lot about the insect apocalypse. And, you know, bees pollinate a third of the crops on the planet. And it's real simple. We want to keep eating. We got to save these creatures. So I think that prompts some people. I also think because more and more backyard beekeepers like myself are popping up, it's seeming more accessible. And I think the old-fashioned fear of the cloud of bees chasing Elmer Fudd and the cartoons is finally going away, and people are realizing that bees don't go on the attack. But the only thing I tell people to consider before they start is getting bees is like getting a dog. You can't just go on vacation. You need a bee babysitter, especially in the spring and summer when they're pulling in a lot of honey and getting real big and swarming. So you have to be committed to it, and you have to study a little bit of entomology and figure out what to do about pests and diseases, and you have to monitor your hive. And if you're willing to do that, then all the rewards will come to you.
Yeah, those rewards, and you called it the magic of bees. So I'm going to tell you a little story that talks about the magic of bees in a way that I find kind of fascinating. My daughter, who is in her final year of a MFA, last summer was over in Europe, and as part of her trip, she did an add-on and received a grant to go to Spain and look at, I guess they were hieroglyphs of bees in caves that date back thousands of years, and research that. And, you know, and I found that fascinating, that people would be putting up cave pictures of bees and really identifying them as bees. So that magic has been with mankind for an awful long time.
Oh, that is so amazing, that trip. I've seen pictures of those hieroglyphs in lots of bee books, and to actually see it is so special.
Yeah, she was quite thrilled with that, and you know, felt really special to have been able to do that. But that's the magic of the bees. It draws people to these interesting things and drew people to do cave art, you know, thousands of years ago about bees. There's a really interesting connection with all of that appeal.
Yeah, people have been worshiping bees for millions desert. You know, there are other places where there are petroglyphs, hieroglyphs. They found honey in King Tut's tomb, and it was still good. Honey is a natural antibacterial substance, so it lasts. It doesn't spoil. There are so many myths of bees, and I think we're just amazed that, you know, they put chaos into order. And I think as humans, we find that incredibly fascinating. The honeycomb they make is a hexagon shape, which is the smartest stacking shape of any. You know, they could have made squares, they could have made triangles, but the hexagon is the strongest and it holds the most honey. And it's just little things like that. How do they know? How do they figure it out? So they're just full of wonder for me.
Yeah, the genius of bees. You start the book with a quote by William Shakespeare. So work the honeybees, creatures that by a rule in nature teach the art of order to a peopled kingdom. And that spoke to me, the art of order, when your life feels otherwise pretty chaotic, tumultuous, and topsy-turvy.
Yeah, the opposite of a dysfunctional family is probably a beehive,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
I mean, they're a factory. They have a system of jobs and promotion, and they promote up through those jobs as they get older. And when they're born, they're janitors and they clean the hive, and then they age and they become like water and pollen receivers from the foragers, and then they become nurses and they feed the babies. And some branch off and specialize. There's architects who build the wax, and chefs who fan the nectar to pull out the water content and turn it into honey. And there are guard bees who guard the entrance. And then when you're most advanced, you get to be a forager and go out and collect the food.
Yeah.
I find that just really, really cool.
It's all, the more stories you hear about bees, the more cool you realize they are. And just yesterday, in fact, I was listening to this great podcast called Ologies, and it was on thermophysiology. It talked about the Japanese hornet that will go into a hive of Japanese honeybees, and the Japanese honeybees are fine, but they had imported some Australian honeybees, and this Japanese hornet would go in and destroy and kill all of the honeybees. And the researchers wondered how that could be. And it turned out that the Japanese honeybees had adapted and over you know, centuries, millennia, whatever, that their body, they could withstand 117 degrees Fahrenheit, whereas the Japanese hornet could only withstand 114 degrees Fahrenheit. The Japanese honeybees would then go in and surround the hornet and create all this heat, almost like just this thermal ball of heat, and would literally just toast the Japanese hornet. But the Australian honeybees did not have this capacity, right? Because they had never had to adapt to fend off a predator. That was just a great story.
Yeah, that reminds me. I mean, I get sent probably 2 links a day from friends about, you know, some scientific study about bees. And one recently was that bees are learning math. They were taking bees in a lab and rewarding them if they chose the thing that had more numbers on it, something like that. And then the bees would remember how to get more food. I don't know, something like that. But they were proving that bees had a memory and they could figure out which is more and which is less when given a choice.
Wow. Do you get a chance to read all the links that your friends send you?
I usually post them immediately unless they look fishy to me, and then I give them an eyeball. But I and then I post them immediately because my bees have their own Facebook page. So I like to keep all the bee stuff there. And so I just usually put it there. And then when I'm traveling and have some time, I'm held hostage in an airplane seat, I read them all.
Meredith, I know that your focus has been on honeybees and being a beekeeper of honeybees, but there are many, many different species of bees, and they all do different things in different ways. And I was unaware of this, but I read something, just a quick news feed during the last week that talked about a big event down in Salt Lake City where they were building backyard bee houses, not for honeybees, but just for bees. And there was a workshop, and they were, you know, showing people how to build these houses for all the other types of bees, because we don't want to neglect them. But have you had a chance to kind of delve into the other bees that exist out there, or are you really just happy communing with honeybees?
Tim, I'm so glad you brought that up, because the honeybee steals the limelight. There are 20,000 species of bees, as you pointed out, and they are all pollinators as well, or I should say most of them are pollinators as well, and they're also important. And yes, what you're talking about are some, they're called pollinator palaces or bug hotels, and these are bees that live individually. Honeybees are the only ones that live in a huge colony and share resources, but most bees live in a hole in the ground, like bumblebees, or they live in a hole in the side of your house, or they live in the wood pile. And these are mason bees and carpenter bees, and what they like to do is lay their eggs in this hole. It's usually like a long tube or a tunnel they like. And then they'll bring honey and pollen in for their eggs and make like a little, they'll mix it together into a ball. They call it bee bread. And then when those eggs hatch, they crawl out of the hole and, you know, rinse, wash, repeat. But these are wonderful little creatures. And yes, I have a pollinator hotel in my backyard. You can make them yourself. I just bought one quickly online. I wanted it for actually my birthday present. But you can make them with tubes, like, or hollow reeds, or even straws. Just make sure you plug up one end and get a bunch of these tubular structures and tie them together. And you can hang them up. I mean, they can just be suspended, and they provide great little homes for these alternative kinds of bees.
Do you have an alternative bee living in your home?
So I'm sorry, say that again?
Do you have an alternative bee living in that home that you got as a present?
I keep checking. It's only been up for a few weeks, so not yet. But ladybugs can also use it, and butterflies and moths, and it's a great thing to do. And I like to actually talk to kids and show them what they are and help them make them, and they're great.
Meredith, what is the name of your bees Facebook page?
It's the Honey Bus.
Okay.
It's beekeeping. You know, it's beekeeping at the Honey Bus.
Okay, we'll look it up and post it on our site along with your interview. And we would be remiss without talking about the Honey Bus really quickly. And it ties into that your grandpa, for me, is the epitome of the old California. You know, the Honey Bus is this old decommissioned army bus that sits in the backyard somewhere. It's in Big Sur, right?
Carmel Valley.
Carmel Valley. Oh, up Carmel Valley Road?
Yeah. Okay. His hives were in Big Sur, and the bus was behind his house in Carmel Valley.
Yeah, I mean, what a character he is. And so you named the bus, or the book, in his honor, I would assume, the Honey Bus. What a great thing.
Well, that's what he called it. It was his Honey Bus. Yeah, it was a World War II Army bus, 1951, green. And he gutted it and sold the engine to a friend for, you know, like $600, and then tore out all the seats and built his honey bottling factory inside. And, you know, he built it himself out of old spare junk. And it was, it just held this like Willy Wonka fascination over me. And we'd spend a lot of time in there in the summer during the harvest, and he would just talk to me about how bees solved problems. And it sort of doubled as our confessional because nobody else was listening. The rest of the world was sealed off from us, and we could just hang out. And I knew, like, even before I wrote the first word of this story, I knew that that's what I wanted the title to be. Mm-hmm. And thank goodness my editor and my publisher agreed, because I hear that often, more often than not, writers don't choose their titles. But it's just got such a, like you said, like a 70s California pre-tech sort of hippie vibe, which is what Grandpa was. So I love that they stuck with it. And the photo on the front, that is my grandfather's honey bus. That's the real thing.
The honey bus. The honey spinner powered, the pump powered by a lawnmower engine, forcing the honey through a network of plumbing pipes.
Yeah,
I love it.
Exactly.
Does the honey bus still exist on that property?
No, Grandpa passed in 2015. Right. You know, I toyed with the idea of taking the bus, but seriously, where was I going to put this thing? I mean, it wasn't even drivable. I'd have to truck it somewhere. And it was literally falling apart. There were rust holes all around, all up through the roof. And no, so a relative sold it for scrap, I believe. Mm.
That honey bus would have looked nice on the salt flats in the West Desert out of Salt Lake City.
Yeah, wouldn't it? Yeah. It was like, you know, Grandpa was steampunk before steampunk was cool.
Yeah. Oh, I love your grandpa. The Honey Bus, a memoir of loss, courage, and a girl saved by bees. Meredith May, thank you so much for joining us. We really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you, Lynn and Tim. I really had a good time.